The following message was recorded at the No Regrets Men's Conference. More information about the conference is available at noregretsconference.org. Feel free to make copies of this message for others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission.
I live on the left coast, amongst the barbarians. Truth to it. Come back here and see an organized church like this in a culture that's Midwestern. It's a different world than the one I live in. But I'm delighted to be here with you guys. How many of you are pastors in here? Or elders, or you're a pastor's man, or all of us. So we're all in church leadership in some form. Let me tell you a little bit about my pilgrimage. I grew up in a home that was a wonderfully Christian home because of my father. I wasn't going to mention this today, but it seems so right since he's been on my mind all morning. He passed away this last Tuesday at 9:03 in the morning on 2/16, at 94 years of age. A rock, a Psalm 1 man, a quiet man. We call him our quiet giant. He was always the pastor's man. If you know what I mean. In fact, humanly speaking, I think that's probably one of the major reasons I'm a pastor. My father so loved and admired his pastors that that his two sons, myself and my brother, who's been a chairman of the elders in his church, were actually forming a little ministry called Careth Springs Lodge, so that within a year or so, we hope that you'll be able to come to Oregon for 4, 5, 6 days and hang out in a beautiful little spot looking at the mountains and loving life, because we love you. And anybody that does what you do deserves some breaks, and they don't often come unless you get away. So Oregon, believe me, is far, far away. Not just geographically, culturally, politically, every other way. But Dad taught us to love our pastor. He basically said, Pastor, you preach the word of God and live faithful to it, and I'll have your back the rest of your life. So just yesterday I was going, this is not part of what we're doing this hour, but we're just going to start in a few seconds. I was going through last will and testaments and those sorts of things, and in his most precious papers in a little leather binder were notes. He had taken it, very small handwriting, was very precise, and they were notes from when I was a child in a church in Central Washington that was experiencing leadership difficulties, not because of the pastor, but because of those well-intentioned dragons that we've all met in the ministry along the way. And why those was with his most precious papers, I'm not certain, but I have an idea. He loved the church. He believed it was the only thing God was doing on the planet, and he was therefore going to be in it. I remember when he made that decision, he was 32, I was 8 years old, and our lives changed. My mother did not know Christ. She was from a romping-stomping, beer-drinking, tail-kicking outfit, and we were in a coal mine, miner town. My dad and my grandpa were coal miners in the early days, so she didn't want anything to do with this religion that Byron had got. In fact, she was a little insecure that he might have fallen in love with somebody else, even if his name was Jesus. It was bugging her. But Dad, faithful like a rock, when he got a hold of Jesus, and Jesus got a hold of him, everything Crawford was preaching this morning became my father's life. I will probably share some of that in the talk this afternoon, because he is a man of the book, to the point that the people around our church have called him Solomon, the wise. Because he knows the book, he lives the book, an anchor. And his love for the church was overwhelming. So I grew up in that Christian home with a man like that. He and I were the only two that went to church at first. My sister was too young, my brother wasn't born, my mother didn't want anything to do with it, Dad and I. Over the years, he led my mother to Christ, he led me to Christ, he led my sister to Christ, he led my brother to Christ. And on this day, all 38 of his direct descendants, 100%, walk with Jesus. It's an incredible statistic. It doesn't happen except when you have a quiet giant who walks straight. And we call him the rock. When those ads on Chevy the truck came out, we said, they don't know what a rock is. We Webbers know what a rock is, Pop. You know, you don't talk a whole lot. You don't say a whole bunch. But the winds blow and the culture moves around, and you're that rock that is immovable in the middle of all of our lives. And so when we're singing this morning and worshiping, I'm looking up that rapture chute, you know. and I'm picturing him singing at the top of his lungs. I may share some of this in the third hour, but the last hour. But he, very humble, great sense of humor. His last words on the day before he died were to me. I said, "Pop, how you feeling?" He says, "Oh, he couldn't talk. You know, he's right down there toward the end." He says, "A little rough. A little rough. You're within that much of death, and it's a little rough, you know." And then as I left, I kissed him on the forehead, which I always did. We were not from a hug and kissing outfit. We're German coal miners, you know. "What are you doing? You know, stand back." But my kids taught me how to hug, and I taught Dad how to hug, and we hug a lot now. But I kissed him on the forehead, and I said, "Dad, you're a really good man." Now, he loved theology, and he believed all the right doctrines. And so he didn't wink, but there was a little grin here, and he said, "Sometimes." So he was just a champion and a quiet one. But he loved the church, and therefore I did. But then I saw all the stuff that we've all seen in churches. You know, I've seen the well-intentioned dragons run pastors out of town on rails, and it really ticked me off in seventh grade because his son Danny was my best buddy, and I lost Danny at that point. So I went off to college in the 60s, and you know what the 60s were like. Some of you do, and some of you have heard. Everything was upside down, and so I went upside down too. Not morally, because the rock's fingerprint was too strong on my life. So I never went immoral. I never got drinking or any of that stuff, you know, that was way verboten for good Baptists like we were. You know what I mean? So I didn't do that, but I left the faith intellectually, and I didn't worry about that. I just was going another direction. My folks didn't understand me. My wife, then when we got married my junior year in college, she didn't understand me. I didn't understand me, but I didn't worry about it because the Army came into my life and it filled the vacuum. It also transformed my life, but I didn't know it at the time until I was almost done. And you face some of those ultimates like life and death in Vietnam, and you wonder why you're alive. And in my case, I met Linda on R&R in Hawaii. I was 24 years old. She was 22. And our little 16-month-old son, his lifespan had doubled since I'd last seen him 8 months before. And I was laying on this beach with my wife in this two-piece bathing suit, which is memorable to me for Baptists, you know. And I had my arm around her, and here was little Kent playing in the little surf rolling up on the sand. And I've been asking myself, why am I alive? Why are my friends not? Why do I exist? And what would it matter that anybody named Stu had ever lived anyway? What is this all about? And all those stories from the little purple-haired ladies in Vacation Bible School, which never connected, there were great stories, but they never connected. And all those messages that I never knew I was listening to by our pastor. You know, I was too busy chasing Linda. We've been together since we were 15 and 13. And we'll be married 50 years this summer. A miracle. We're both firstborn Germans, aggressive, assertive. And what Crawford said today, I can say. I actually love what used to be quirks to me. You know? And they tell me that when you approach 50 years, the true intimacy becomes better than ever. And I'm a testimony to that fact. I'm not talking about sexuality, though that's still part of our lives. But I'm talking about true intimacy, you know? It's real. So I laid there and I thought on that beach, you know, the only reason with those things coming back to me that I'm alive is for my bride and kids and his bride and kids. And I haven't thought any theology for 5 years, maybe six, but it came back largely because of a dad and pastors. So hang in there, you know. And watch what God produces out of your ministries. So I came back from Vietnam and I decided I got to know the Bible because I want to know how all those stories fit together, because I'm a German and it's linear logic, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And so I just went out, I'm going to go to 1 year of seminary. And that year was so incredibly spiritually rich, I almost exploded. I had never seen stuff like this that just really filled my heart and soul. And so we stayed the whole time and finished the program. And the last thing I was going to be was a pastor, because I had seen. And then knowing that wasn't the right thing for me to think when I'm in seminary, of all things, for goodness sakes, I went down and met with the pastor that when I was in 7th or 8th grade, got run out of town. He was pastoring now in Oregon, and I went down and met with Orville H. Williams. And I told him, I confessed, I'm in seminary, I love Jesus, I want to serve him, but I'm not sure it's right for me to say I'm not going to be a pastor. He said, well, why do you not want to be? And of course, he knew that I'd seen him being manhandled. And I said, because my wife is going to be my wife, she's not going to be the pastor's wife. And my children are going to be my kids, they're not going to be the pastor's kids. And I'm not ever going to let anything change that. And that hasn't changed. They're mine, all the good and the bad, you know, and she's mine, and she doesn't belong to the church, though the church stands on her shoulders in a lot of ways. And so I drove back up from his place in Eugene to Portland to seminary, and we had been studying 1 John in this little Bible study I was leading, and the Spirit of God pulled some things out of there and said, the whole reason that Jesus became a human being was so he could be manhandled. The things we have seen and touched. And that took that resistance off my chest. And so from, we finished seminary and I worked for the school for a little while. And then I realized that I was supposed to be a pastor. And so for the last 40, I lose track, going on, probably the last 45 years, I've been a pastor. Retired officially from our church 5 years ago. Still have an office on the grounds, out of the main office building. And still have a secretary that who helps me stay organized, because it's not my strength. And worship there. Preach there once a month because the lead pastor asks me to. And then I get to do some things like this on other weekends. And we live a full life. And when I go home tomorrow, I will spend Sunday afternoon with my best friend of 45 years, whose dad was a pastor. That's why he's my best friend. We're going to watch the Super Bowl together. And then on Monday, my brother and sister and I are going to drive Dab's body up to the old Central Washington coal mining hometown, and the three of us are going to bury Dad, and it'll be a strong thing. So you pray for me this afternoon when I'm preaching, that one, my head and heart will stay where they're supposed to in the book, and that I won't get ambushed by my own emotions. Not that that would be a disgrace. I'm way past that now, but I don't want to be a distraction. Okay? That's just kind of our secret for now. Okay? When you hit your 70s, you get to have a prescription, and they dry your mouth out. So, I drink a lot. Let me just read to you a couple statements. Before that, let me just mention this. You know the high fives we like to do? I'm a little older, so they used to do them. Now they just bump fists or chests. But I like to think Jesus had at least two of those with his disciples. Of course, the big one was like this, with his hands out this way, when he said, it's finished. I picture him and his father doing high fives like this. It was more like this. But the other time that I picture Jesus in a high five, a big moment for him, and he got so excited, he said, blessed are you, Peter, because you get it. And he said, I picture him going around to those disciples around the headwaters of the Jordan and saying something like, I will build my church. And I love that. I've always wanted to be part of a team. I've always wanted to be part of a good company. I've always wanted to be part of a large family. And I don't believe there's a better company, organization, or family on the earth. So let me read you a statement that comes from Bill Hybels. You know, Bill, courageous leadership. We're now going to get into our subject. There's nothing like the local church when it's working right. Its beauty is indescribable. Its power is breathtaking. Its potential is limitless. It comforts the grieving and heals the broken in the context of community. It builds bridges to seekers and offers truth to the confused. It provides the resources for those in need and opens its arms to the forgotten, the downtrodden, the disillusioned. It breaks the chains of addictions, frees the oppressed, offers belonging to the marginalized of this world. And whatever the capacity for human suffering, the church has a greater capacity for healing and wholeness. I believe that's an excellent statement. I'm going to read you another statement. It comes from one of the young kids that grew up in our church and became a missionary and has been across the world and lived in third and fourth world countries. And a very brilliant, beautiful blonde girl. You wouldn't normally expect her to be where she's been. But she says, before leaving for the mission field, my greatest concern had been getting sick. And during the treks and other physical hardships, I was surprised, therefore, when the hardest struggle turned out to be with the missionaries' relationships with each other. I had been told that I should expect this, and it's one of the biggest problems on the mission field, and yet I couldn't imagine it being all that hard. I mean, you would think it would be fairly easy to work together because, after all, we're Christians who have the same ultimate goals and desires, and this is true, but missionaries, no, this is true, but humans, I would correct her a little bit there, we humans also tend to be independent, and each has his or her own philosophy or strategy. Now throw all these personalities together under the incredible stresses of life out in the middle of nowhere with little or no relief from each other or the ministry. Whew, she says, the trials that come with those kinds of conditions make such sufferings as living without electricity or a supermarket the least of our concerns. This is more than just an emotional battle, but a definite spiritual one. Since how effective can our ministry be if we're not a unified team? So very true. We Germans are simple people. We keep things the main thing. Is it the main thing? Always remain the main thing. You've heard that. It's also true. You can do so many things right and well, but if you forget the main thing, you lose the game. I was in junior high watching our high school basketball players, whom we almost worshipped. You know, they had hair on their arms and legs and things, and we were going to be like that someday. And so we went to all the games, and they were playing our crosstown rival in this particular game I have in mind. Always a dogfight, no matter where they were relative to each other in the standings. Tied up, close, point or two at halftime. They still did a center jump at halftime in those days. That's how long ago I was in junior high. And our guys controlled the tap. Big old fella hit it to the side, who saw the guard going down the other side, preset play, threw the ball like that. One dribble, kissed the glass in the square, 2 points. Bedlam. In those days, there were 5,000 people at those high school games. Bedlam cut loose, and then everybody recognized at the same time, the refs and the players and the fans, wrong basket. Now, you're going to think that this is a preacher's hyperbole, okay? But it's not. It's true. Our guys lost the game that night by one basket, 2 points. They'd put the winning margin in the other team's basket perfectly. It was a perfectly executed fast break. And they did so many things well, but they forgot the goal. Wrong goal. Went the wrong direction and got beat. One time, y'all heard of Vince Lombardi around here. One of my treasures, by the way, is a poster of Vince Lombardi with some of his sayings. And it's signed by Bart Starr and Paul Horning and Jim Taylor and Ray Nitschke and Fuzzy Thurston and Jerry Kramer. And there's one more. Forgotten. But that's pretty special. I had a friend who played for the Packers in the 90s. And he was playing golf with them on a fundraiser. And he got him to sign this thing and gave it to me.
Oh, we
got to
know who that is.
Kenny Rutgers. Yeah, he was on the Stars, Brett Favre's All-Star poster, MVP poster, because he had the blind side. Yeah. Kenny's a good man. 300 pounds and a six-pack. Now 265 and a keg. I'm just teasing. He doesn't have a keg. I have the keg. But I love the Packers. I still do. Packers and Seahawks. Now I'm a little bit divided in my loyalty. But Mike Holmgren, who coached both, is the first cousin of my best friend of 45 years. Although, like Mike told me when I did the chapel one time, since I became coach, I've had a lot of cousins. But this one's actually true. Vince, one day after they got their socks kicked off in the late 60s, just got beat really bad on an afternoon that he didn't like, of course. You've probably heard the story because it's legendary, but I don't think he gave a Monday off. In fact, in my mind, this has happened on a Monday after their game, and he stood in front of the team, and he said, "Gentlemen, we have to go back to the basics. We didn't tackle, we didn't run, we didn't do this, we didn't do that." He pulled out from the podium, held it up, and said, "Gentlemen, this is a football, okay? The point of this, get this football across that goal." So what I want to share in the half hour we've got left is what I think is the fundamental mission of the church, both gathered when we're worshiping and learning together, and scattered when we're out amongst the people. Our mission is the same, and it's the main thing. And if we have the greatest programs in the world and the greatest choirs in the world and the greatest building in the world and all those kinds of things, if we forget these fundamental things, we will lose our whole mission and purpose. So you know most of this. You're all pastors, but just humor me for a minute, okay? And we'll walk through a little theology. What is the primary purpose of the church? You can go Westminster, you can go Baptistic, you can do whatever you want to. What's the primary mission of the church? To glorify God, right? That's what it's all about. So the purpose is to get this ball across that goal line. The purpose is to glorify God. And if you'll just take it by faith for a minute, the whole point of the glory of God is to be a physical, visible, demonstrable display of his great invisible character. So whether it was the pillar of fire or the clouds or the Shekinah or Jesus, we beheld his glory, full of grace and truth, the only begotten Son of God, it's always a physical, visible resemblance. Whether that was housed in the tabernacle or in the temple or in Jesus' body, he commissioned his body, the church, to be the physical, visible demonstration of his great invisible character. So that's our purpose. That's the main thing. That's why we exist. That's why we do what we do. Secondly, if the purpose is his glory, to reflect him, to look like him, to live like him, what is our pattern? What do we follow? What do we strive to look like? God. Now, you don't misunderstand. Look like Jesus. I mean, that's more palatable. But our whole point as a church, if we're going to glorify him, is to learn, everybody learning, youngest cradle member to oldest elder, everybody learning together to live like God the Father, Son, and Spirit do. How do they live? Well, you know, there's all kinds of verses in the Scripture that describe him, descriptors of him that are just mind-blowing. You know, you read Ezekiel's impression of the glory of God sometime, and it just knocks your socks off. But there are only a few places in Scripture that say, this is what God is. You hear what I'm saying? You know 1 John 4:8 and 10. God is love. So love is somewhere in our mission as a church. God is love. God is light or truth or transparency, okay? What you see is what you get. So that's part of the glory of God as I see it. Now, we're to be a physical, visible resemblance of his love and his transparency and truthfulness, honesty, integrity. And God is spirit. And we who are born again are spiritual beings. And when I think of this, I choose to think of the Spirit of God not only as the third member of the Trinity, but as somewhere close to the essence of what he is. So You can't get any closer to anybody than to understand and know and relate to their spirit, who's a born-again believer. Call it the heart if you want to. Call it the spirit. But here we're talking about spirit, for God is spirit, okay? So God is love. God is truth or transparency. And God is spirit, the most intimate level of our existence, okay? And then God is... I don't care for the word unity as much as I do the word oneness. Unity sounds like an organization. Oneness sounds like a couple. The two shall be one. And so I think the whole mission of the church and everything we're to be striving for, if we miss this, it doesn't matter how many evangelism explosion programs we have, we're not going to be living right at the cusp of our mission. So I see our job as leaders is to take people where they wouldn't otherwise go. It's not natural for human beings to love one another as 1 John describes, which is total sacrifice without any attraction or any compulsion. It's just total sacrifice, 1 John 4:10, is to learn to live together with that kind of constantly initiating sacrificial action for one another. That's love, okay? And transparently. Nothing in the spirit that is hidden. With each other as believers. That's really there. When you get to living together in loving, transparent, spirit-to-spirit oneness, other things have to fall away because that's God. He's like that. He is at his essence. When it says God is love, it means doesn't mean love is God, because you can't turn the predicate around, but you can understand its esse, his essence. God is essentially loving, truthful, spirit-to-spirit oneness, Father, Son, and Spirit. Father, I pray that they, and not only them, but those who follow after them, that they could be one the way we are one. That is, to me, one of the most phenomenal statements in Scripture. That Jesus sees Cinderella, the bride with spot and wrinkle, so closely and intimately that he dreams that we as a church would experience the kind of loving, truthful, spiritual oneness that the Trinity does. That is blind-blowing to me. And so that's a football, you know. So everything has to somehow that we're doing reflect that. So we don't even have to fuss about most things, you know. I remember when we were building our first building. We built it all ourselves, concrete tilt-up. We had a guy who does that. We found a crane operator. We almost frustrated him to death because we didn't know what we were doing on the other end of those 25-ton tilt-up panels. But we got it built, and we moved. We were almost to move in, and we were just finishing the platform. And I love men, and I love masculine men, and I love the fact that men can be not only at home but thrive in the church instead of the other way around. So I want the building to be comfortable for men. And I'm on the way to the architect with Mary Spinks, whose maiden name was Schlenker. She's even more German than I am. And she's a beautiful woman, both in body and in heart. But she's German, and so am I. So we're driving to the architect's to talk about the way the front of the platform looks, which is where all the eyes are, which is where the guys need to be comfortable, you know, I think. And it was poofy and fluffy, and it had a Bijou Theater drapes and all this stuff. And so I was trying to talk Mary out of it. Mary's in charge of that. And we're driving along in the car on the way to the architect, and the argument, it became an argument because of me. It was just a conversation until at some point I said, well, Mary, I don't know how else to say this, and I don't know how this even comes to my mind, but it reminds me of my grandmother's underwear. Now, I had never seen my grandmother's underwear, so I don't know. But what I meant was those little frilly things, you know. And And Mary said something like, well. And then the Spirit of God washed over me and reminded me of these truths. The main thing is not the Bijou Theater appearance. The main thing is the way you and Mary relate to each other. And so I apologized, and I said, I'm really sorry. Can you forgive me? And now that I think about it, I don't really care what the front looks like, because we're just going to preach there. And we're still best friends to this day. I'm not best friends. My best friends are all guys, but she's a very dear friend to this day. But my point is, if I hadn't had the football held up to here when I'm driving in that car, I would have muffed it badly, you see. So I think the essence of leadership is understanding the mission, which is to learn together to live like God lives and display him in those relationships to the world. So, and then the problems of the church, you know, we've talked about the purpose and the pattern and all, and we've talked about God's nature being the pattern. The posture of the church is God's image, which I think is linked to that oneness. We don't have time to do all of that just now, but if we've got all those things, then we come to the problems of the church, and the problems of the church are the ingredients to experience, out of which to experience that kind of oneness. Because we all know how many of you have ever gone camping? In the rain for 3 days. That kind of a camping experience either blows you apart or draws you together. Adversity usually draws us together. So I try to view the problems that we run into as God's ingredients. You know, he's shaking it into the body to give us opportunity now to learn together to live like Christ. And when we started the church years ago, this is a fun thing. You know, how many of you know Randy Alcorn? Randy was in my high school youth group when I had been the youth pastor in East County while I was in seminary. Now he's gone on to Multnomah, and I'm working at the seminary, and we'd always sort of prayed that wouldn't it be something if we could minister together someday. And so we started that church together, and he was on staff for 14 years, and I was on staff for 33 years. We're both still in the church. We're both still part of it. We both understand that when you pass the guide on to the next guy, you're out of command. And we both stay out of all the decisions. We don't go to any meetings. And we both love it because we don't have to go to any meetings. You know, it's really good. But it's in those meetings that we get to practice the theology that we preach on Sunday, you see. So if I can go to a meeting about the front of the church or the color of the carpet with this leadership mission in mind, it colors everything. And that's what's been the case for Good Shepherd. Our first 25 or 30 years, we had no congregational controversies, except one. And that was handled as well as I think any human beings could handle it. As you know, Randy was involved in what we, you know, kind of put the umbrella of Operation Rescue over. Randy is the ultimate pro-lifer, and should be, and is. He's also, of all the Christians I've ever met, the one who walks the talk most faithfully. I love, respect, admire, and would walk with him anywhere. He is so stinking bright, it's not fair, if you know what I mean. In fact, I told him, Randy, you are so bright that you have to be really careful, because even when you're right, you can be wrong. Because it's not all logic, you know. And we he's a thinker. He's a real thinker and brilliant. Where was I going with that? Oh, there was controversy. That was hard for the church because Randy and I were the two, I used to say primates. I meant primaries in the preaching pulpit. And now we were on opposite sides of an issue. Not pro-life. I was very pro-life. But I wouldn't go down and blockade the clinics because it was against the law. I grew up in the 60s. I'd seen enough of that stuff, and that was probably affecting me as much as anything. And Randy, who's brilliant, says, well, you know, Stu, I understand that, but I know that if you knew my daughter Karina was going to be murdered on appointment, you would be there. I said, I would, Randy, and I wouldn't hold hands in front of the garage. I would blow away the one that was going to murder her. And that's where it will go if we're not careful. So I drew the line at civil disobedience at that point in my life. I'm getting more lenient now. You know, we live in a culture of liars, and it seems like the Constitution... I'm getting off track, so get back. So even in that, you can imagine, I'm of Apollos or I'm of Cephas. There was I'm of Stu and I'm of Randy, and that could have just gone like that. It did not. We're still in the church. We stood together up on the platform, remembering this is a football, and we held our hands up and said, yes, we feel very differently about this civil disobedience in this case, but we will not let it break our friendship or divide us, and we will not allow it to divide you. And we survived even that, because this is a football, you see. I guess what I'm saying is, though I grew up Nazarene and Conservative Baptist, two pretty, you know, my dad, after being an elder at Good Shepherd for a few years, said, you know, Stu, I probably have to swallow a little crow here to say this, but I could never go back, because we're learning to do the Bible. And that was a good thing. So that's basically the seminar on leadership. This is a football. This is the primary mission, to get that ball across that line, to learn together to live like Father, Son, and Spirit do. Now, how did they live? Well, let's look here at Acts. Let's watch it in the first church. This is Acts. You remember that magnificent passage in chapter 2 when the whole world saw something phenomenal, and so did all the believers, and it was a magnificent display of God's power as he gave birth to the church. But you also know that there are summary statements in the Greek epistolary formula and the way things are recorded. And when you come to one of those paragraphs that's a summary statement, it's describing everything that just went before it. Well, here's what the way the summary paragraph at the end of chapter 2 reads. And all those who had believed were together, and they had all things in common, and they'd be habitually selling their property and possessions, and were sharing them with all as anyone might have need, and day by day, continuing with one mind in the temple and breaking bread from home to home, they were taking their meals together with gladness and sincerity of heart. Call that spiritual oneness, okay? No wax. Praising God and having favor with all the people, and the Lord was adding to their number day by day those who were being saved. The most effective tool of evangelism in that first century church's presence was the way they treated each other. And the Lord was adding daily. Who wouldn't want to join a thing like that? You see? Who wouldn't? Here's the summary statement at the end of chapter 4. And the congregation of those who believed were of one heart and soul. And not even one of them was claiming that anything belonging to him was his own, and all things were as common to them. And with great power, the apostles were giving witness to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and abundant grace was upon them all, for there was not a needy person amongst them. The greatest witness and evangelistic tool, the greatest witness to the resurrection, was the way believers treated each other. They got along so well. The apostles gave testimony of the resurrection right on the heels of that. So somewhere near the heart of all we do is that kind of thing. Now, just to kind of... you guys are all Bible guys, and this is sort of intimidating, you know. Here's page one of the Bible, and it's kind of pedantic. Then God said, let there be, and it was so, and God said, and let there be, and it was so, and God said, let there be, and it was so. God just speaks, calls it the work of his finger in another place, creating the universe, you know, just and salvation, strong right arm. And then he says, all this, then God said, then God said, then God said. And you get to verse 26. Then God said, let us make man in our image. It now becomes conversational. It's, if you can believe, the creation of the universe was basically ho-hum. It kind of reads that way, you know. And then he gets to the creation of mankind, the capstone of creation. in his image. And he says, now then, whoa, you can almost see him rubbing his hands together. You know, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. And he did, male and female, two very different creatures, men and women. And then he brought, you know the story, in chapter 2. And the Lord God fashioned into a woman the rib which he'd taken from the man and brought her to the man. And the man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. He is Ish, piercer, a penetrator, initiator. She is Isha, receptor, relational, that sort of thing. So the whole point is the summary statement, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother. This relationship actually supersedes a relationship with your own kin. For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave. That's Hebrew for gorilla glue. Shall cleave to his wife. And they shall become one. Flesh and more. The whole. So it's on page one of the Bible that we're created that way, to live that way, and we need to learn to live that way. Of course, sin destroyed that. They started hiding from God and throwing rocks at each other, the woman you made, and it destroyed all that. A few chapters later, the flood wipes it out, starts again. A couple chapters later, Tower of Babel. Well, let me just read in Genesis 11 real quick. The verb in Genesis chapter 11, it even mocks the language of God in chapter 1. They said to one another, hey, let us make bricks and burn them. Come, let us build for ourselves a city. You know all of that. And then the verb that dominates the chapter becomes scattered, 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 which breaks God's heart. So right on the heels of that brokenhearted scattering, he gives a promise. He says, I'm not going to let this stand. And the Abrahamic covenant, which still governs history today, comes into place. But here's the verse I wanted you to see. And verse 6, and the Lord said, behold, they are one and have the same language, and this is what they've begun to do. Now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let's go down there and confuse their language. We've got to separate them. It's become a beehive of idolatry, basically. My point is, when God says, look how they've become one, now nothing will be impossible for them. I don't know all the theology in that. I don't know anybody that ever has opened it up. But it does tell me that there's something inherently overpowering in oneness. And that's in the first 11 chapters, which we regard as kind of the prehistory of everything else in the Bible. And you can go through the Bible that way and find it everywhere. I mean, there's more in Genesis, but listen to this. This is a song of ascents. This is David writing this. The people are going for the holy days to Jerusalem. And, of course, Jerusalem is the high ground. And so they sing as they're ascending. Behold, how good and essentially pleasant it is for brothers to dwell together in oneness. It's like, and then he uses these extravagant pictures of oil on Aaron's beard and the dew of Hermon coming down upon the mountains of Zion. It's like the dew of Hermon coming down upon the mountains of Zion, for there, where? And the antecedent? Zion. For there, the Lord commanded the blessing, dash, life forever. So I take it that eternal quality life is somewhere at the heart of oneness. It's there in Zion, the community of God's people, that there exists life forever, eternal life. So I think that's a pretty high commendation. And you know about God calling his people together all across the world. I'll bring them together, Isaiah the prophet. He's so about oneness. But then you get to the New Testament and to the upper room. You've preached it many times. Here's the introduction to the upper room. When therefore he had gone out, he being Judas, when the withholder went out, when the guy who really wasn't one with them went out. Jesus says, now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. And if God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and will glorify him immediately. He's got the glory of God on his mind, wouldn't you say? And then he says, here's this fresh commandment, that you love one another even as I, precisely the way, just so as I have loved you, that you all love one another. That by this men will know that you're mine, your love for one another. And then the upper room unfolds, and you know all those verses. This is my commandment, you love one another just as I've loved you. There is no greater love that you give yourselves away for one another, die for one another. This I command you, that you love one another. It goes through that whole upper room. And then he says at verse 20, I don't ask in behalf of these alone, but for those who also believe in me through their word, as faithful men give to faithful men to give to faithful men, and we come here today, that they may all be one, even as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be in us. I mean, that's what it's going to be forever, life eternal. I pray they might exhibit that here on the planet in some form, that the world may believe that thou didst send me. And the glory which you've given me, I've given them, that they may be one just as we are one. I in them, thou in me, that they may be matured in oneness, and the world may know that you sent me. Gentlemen, this is a football, and that's the key to leadership, I think. Having a clear vision that can be communicated clearly to everybody, infused the whole culture, and we go together. So that, to me, is the essence of church leadership in a nutshell. And we've got, I think we have till 5 after 12. Am I right? Where did Mark go? So we have... yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Would you have any thoughts or questions or even contradictions? Any thoughts about this? Uh-huh.
You know, I love that idea. Ben's obviously oneness is the greatest thing, but how do we get that audacity to walk that out? And then dealing with those who cannot gather around that biblical concept of oneness, you know, they won't let go of their, my football. And I think that's one of the biggest problems that I see is this. Mm-hmm. You either have no ownership at all, or it's all about mine.
Yep. That's why those seagulls in Finding Nemo, you know, mine. That's the church apart from Jesus, you know. Many, many years ago, I mean, you keep at it and keep at it and keep at it. Jesus had a problem with Judas. Judas had a problem with Jesus, and he eventually left. I remember Randy and I went to the Institute of Church Imperatives. Remember Bill Yeager from, I think it was Modesto, California. He was one of the early mega churches that was, the mayor came to Christ and became the pastor of evangelism, and it just kind of took over the community. And Yeager... he answered that question for us when we were just young pastors after he had embarrassed us. Our church is in Boring, Oregon, and it's on the registration because that's where your address is. And so he asked, with these 1,000 pastors there, would the actual Boring pastors please stand? so we did. But he had a little phrase he used, only after lots of patience. And E.V. Hill said almost the same thing when he came to a pastor in residence session that I happened to hear. The little phrase that Yeager used was, he didn't broadcast it, but he called it the carnal corral. And he said, the carnal corral always gathers a few little followers, and if what you're doing is biblical, and it's clearly the mission that God's given to you, those kinds of buds fall off over time. I don't know how else to look at it.
Parable of the wheat and tares comes to mind too.
Yes, yep. And also Jesus, who
tares stay in there for a long time.
Yeah, some of them do. And that's why Jesus, when he went the high five thing, you know, two verses later, Peter says, no, and he says, Satan, out. And Jesus was a loving, godly, was it fair to say he was pretty godly? Yeah. But he called Peter the devil. You know, so there comes a place where you speak the truth, but eventually that's what Yeager said, that carnal corral breaks itself off like a leaf in the fall, and you don't.
It's the truth in love, though.
Pardon?
He is
yes. The truth. Full of grace and truth. And he lists grace first and then truth. And that's a big deal. You would think he would have gone that way, but he went that way. So it is full of grace and truth. And in its repetitive times, 7 times 7, let's see, 490. On the 491st, you don't have to worry about it. No. That's the hard part. But as a leader, try to stay above, have a posture that tries to stay above it and doesn't resort to their tactics or to their ways. And like my dear dad, who just left me, used to say, we are known and read of men. And in the end, we know the truth always prevails, whether it does on this planet or not. So that's where I come from on it. We have, in the last few years, we have, how do I say this? We've inadvertently planted 2 churches. But you know what? The pastors of those 2 churches and I are having breakfast in 2 weeks, and we're going to hang out. We're not going to let it divide us, even though it was a philosophy of ministry that they felt was different and they wanted to go do it, and that's got to be fine with me. To stay above, you know, my youngest son, who's learned a great deal from his grandfather, who's now with the Lord, he says, you know, there's pearls and swine, Dad, but he says, you know, when you wrestle with the pig, you might win, but you still get mud all over you. So don't bother, you know, just don't go wrestling there. And that, these guys are not pigs, they're my friends. In fact, they were the one was on staff with us for years, and very gifted preacher, a very good man. So we're still together.
Well, Paul and Barnabas come to mind too.
Yes.
They separate, and there's yep. Church growth.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And their relationship, I'm sure, healed over time, and they found each other. In fact, I know that, don't I? In the back of my mind, I know that. What's the verse? But yeah. Yeah, those things come back. They do. So Barry and I are having breakfast in a couple of weeks. We're going to have a ball. I could live with Barry in a cabin in Alaska forever, you know.
Well, we are going to be in eternity forever.
Exactly. We might as well start getting along now. Now, I do have one reservation. I don't know if all those rumors were true for a while, but it would be just like the Lord to put me in a condo next to Jane Fonda. Okay, it's 12:05. Thank you. Thank you for your patience, Mark, and for being there.